Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's 2024 primary election is in the books, including a resolution to the contentious Democratic primary for governor.
This was a pretty negative race, and I talked about the negative campaigning against Alon, but you brought up, certainly there was a lot of negative campaigning directed at Matt Meyer as well.
We break down Delaware's primary results with the UD Center for Political Communications' Paul Brewer. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine ways to get more young people involved in politics. Arts Playlist discusses the intersection between arts and social justice. Plus, Enlighten Me explains why seasonal allergies are peaking in Delaware and how you can treat them. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week's Delaware primary brought an end to one of the most watched and most contentious races the state has seen, this year's Democratic primary for governor. It also produced some eye-opening results at both the top of the ticket, where a largely unknown newcomer muscled his way into the U.S. House race, and down ballot, where Delaware's House Speaker is suddenly out of a job. To dive into these storylines, we sat down with University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, to get his analysis of the state of play post-primary. Let's jump right in with the governor's race on the Democratic side. The big question going in this highly contentious race was how much the long-running questions about Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hallong's campaign finance issues would influence the race, as opposed to, say, the questions about outside PAC support for Matt Meyer. Hallong did ultimately lose by a fairly substantial margin to Matt Meyer. Is it fair to say Hallong's issues were the primary or among the primary reasons she lost and Meyer won?
Well, I'll be a little careful here because we only had a little polling in this race, but Hallong entered the race, seemed like in a fairly good position. So she was a two-time incumbent, long-term member of the legislature. She had the endorsement of the outgoing governor, John Carney. So presumably name recognition. In our polling, we found she had at least moderate to substantial name recognition. So clearly something went awry, and the most logical suspect would be all of the attention focused on allegations of campaign finance improprieties.
Is it also fair to say it was the almost like drip, drip, drip nature of it between essentially October and really almost right up to the election itself?
Yes, I think one story might have been easier to put behind her, but there was a string of stories that generated negative publicity for her, and perhaps most importantly, became the fodder of a fairly well-funded negative campaign against her.
And not just on that, but also some of the negative ads that were aimed at her opponent, her main opponent, Matt Meyer. There was a third candidate, Colin O'Mara, but it seemed like it was largely between those two frontrunners. And you mentioned this negative campaigning because, you know, when our reporters were in the field on Tuesday, they heard from many voters they were turned off by the negative campaigning in that race. And some Democratic Party officials suggested to us that it might have even drove turnout down. Turnout wound up at 22%. Down from 32% in the primary in 2020, the last presidential election that had, you know, kind of the same type of races, governor, U.S. House, U.S. Senate on the ballot. Do you think that the tone of the campaign could have affected turnout?
Yeah, so there's longstanding debate in political science whether negative information depresses turnout or whether it persuades people. I think it's at least plausible in this case. Now, it's challenging to get turnout in primaries, so there's a bigger picture there, but this was a pretty negative race, and I talked about the negative campaigning against Hallong, but you brought up, certainly there was a lot of negative campaigning directed at Matt Meyer as well, and I also found it interesting that a lot of this campaigning seems to have been driven by not the campaigns of the candidates themselves, but by PACs.
This negative vibe that surrounded the governor's campaign, is that something the Democrats, you think, are going to need to address in the next few weeks as they start to pivot toward the general election, and maybe even beyond that? Do they need to kind of mend some fences here?
Well, it seemed like a pretty bitter primary battle. And on the one hand, Democrats have been in the driver's seat in statewide elections for a while. So you could look at that and say, well, it doesn't really matter, but it might behoove them to mend fences and, you know, get on the same page, because I think one factor in the Democratic Party's dominance at the statewide level is simply being ideological. Delaware is a blue state, a relatively liberal, relatively progressive state. So any Republican candidate is going to have an uphill task trying to win a statewide election. And it's been a while. What was the last one? Ken Simpler?
Yes, correct. So he was something of an outlier if you look back to like even like 2000. So over two decades, that's kind of like, you know, he and Tom Wagner, who was a longtime Republican auditor, kind of kept getting reelected. But once he was not on the ballot, that office went to the Democrats. But you do bring up an interesting point. I mean, can the GOP candidate in the governor's race, Mike Ramone, seize on a fractious Democratic primary to perhaps give himself a better chance? Perhaps he's already seemed to try to position himself as a kind of more thoughtful, moderate type Republican. His first press release after the primary was about his support for reproductive rights and LGBTQ plus protections. When President Biden stepped away from the presidential race, he actually put out a release thanking the president for his service and saying how much he admired the president. Is that a strategy?
Yeah, and that was the other side that I was going to, the other angle I was going to take on this is that I think another factor in the Republican Party's lack of statewide success in recent cycles has been that the candidates that they've put up have been relatively extreme and not well positioned to win statewide races. I'm thinking here like candidates like Lauren Witzke, right, or Scott Walker. You know, these are not candidates that have a serious chance of winning. Mike Ramone, on the other hand, he was a state rep for quite a while before mm-hmm. this, and has historically presented himself as, I think, a more moderate centrist Republican. So I think he's at least better positioned to do better than a lot of the candidates at the statewide level that the Republican Party has nominated. And on the other hand, I think it's still a challenging task. I think looking back, Colin Bonini ran against Carney. I think he also presented himself as a, you know, a non-fire-breathing Republican. He was actually remarkably congenial with Carney in the debate that we had here at mm-hmm. UD. And it didn't work for him in the end. But, you know, cycles differ.
And perhaps what Ramone's hoping for is a combination of how he presents himself and perhaps some fissures on the Democratic side, maybe, you know, combining into a perfect storm for him, something definitely to keep an eye on. You mentioned the Republican Party, so let's talk a little bit about their side of things. Their endorsed candidates did largely well, with one notable exception. The party-endorsed U.S. House candidate, Danielle Hall, was defeated convincingly by a relatively unknown newcomer, a former state police trooper, John Whalen. You mentioned Scott Walker. This is kind of reminiscent of Walker's win over then-party-endorsed Lee Murphy in 2018. Is there a way to explain this?
Yeah, now I don't know too much about the specifics of that race, I will be honest, but kind of broader impression of where the Delaware GOP is right now, I think potentially a reflection of the national GOP, which is that the Republican Party establishment over the last 10, 15 years has really lost a lot of control over the direction of the party. And I think this really starts both in Delaware and nationally in 2010 with the Tea Party, where you have Christina O'Donnell with a surprise win over Mike Castle. And you mentioned the Murphy Walker. I think it's just not as easy and safe for kind of establishment Republican candidates to coast on that.
So down ballot, the biggest surprise was Delaware House Speaker Valerie Longhurst, who had just ascended to Speaker a year ago, losing to Kamala Smith in the House 15th District Democratic primary. We have seen this recently. A couple of state Senate president pro temps have lost in recent years. Tony DeLuca, Patty Blevins, David McBride in 2012, 2016, and 2020. Is this becoming a bit of a cautionary tale for leadership, Democratic leadership in the state, that the voters are watching and you can't necessarily feel like you're immune from challenges?
Yeah, this does seem to be getting to be a pattern. And it is striking because historically, big picture, incumbents losing in primaries is pretty unusual. And people in leadership losing in primaries is even more unusual. So to see a string of these makes you wonder what is going on here. And I think one factor that could be at play here is that as the Democratic Party has really become the dominant party in Delaware at the statewide level, you see a lot of the tensions and competition over the direction of policy and politics in the state play out at these primary levels. And I think you see a growing tension between the more progressive elements of the party and then the more centrist establishment elements of the party. I think this is a case where Smith identified as a progressive, right?
That's where I was going to go, is, you know, she is a Working Families Party endorsed candidate. That is the progressive branch of the Democratic Party. And this is certainly another feather in their cap. She joins the likes of Eric Morrison, Sophie Phillips, Medina Wilson-Anton, Cindy Romer, and others who have been part of that kind of subset of the Democratic Party who have earned their way into the legislature. Now, in fairness, not all of their endorsed candidates are successful, including the gubernatorial candidate they back, Colin O'Mara. But it does seem like they're growing in influence. Is it fair to say at this point that they have kind of shown that Delaware is moving a bit into a more progressive spot?
I think there's been a pattern of certainly not all progressive candidates have met with electoral success at the primary level. But there has been a string of candidates who have, and I think at the policy level, the impact of that might be to push the state more progressively in what the legislature does.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next, which is, I mean, obviously there's still a general election to be held, but, you know, Matt Meyer clearly has everything going in his favor. And he clearly is more progressive than John Carney. I think nobody would argue that point. Pairing that with a more progressive House in general and perhaps more progressive leadership than Valerie Longhurst or before her Pete Schwarzkopf brought to the table, is that a sign that some progressive legislation that perhaps stalled or some people say got watered down wouldn't in the coming years if all the chips fall the way they're expected to?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something major to keep an eye on if Meyer manages to win the gubernatorial election and some of these candidates who won their primaries go on to win in the general election. Is for a Democratic-dominated state, Delaware's had some progressive legislation, but I think a lot of progressives have felt that leadership in the legislature and in the governor's office has been sometimes a roadblock to going as far as they would want to go. So will it go further? I think that's definitely something to keep an eye on over the next 2 years.
Thanks to University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, we dive into ways to support youth civic engagement and get more young people involved in politics. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As we put the Delaware primary behind us and look ahead to the much-anticipated general election, we note that young voters are poised to greatly influence the election. So it begs the question, how is our youth prepared to vote and participate in civic life? This week, Delaware Public Media's Colin McKinnon spoke with Alberto Medina, communications lead at the Tufts University Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, also known as CIRCLE, to learn more about youth civic engagement and ways to get young people involved in politics.
CIRCLE has published recent reports on supporting youth civic engagement and what non-college youth need to engage in civic life. Before we get to those reports, let's start with a baseline here about civics. I think education is a huge part of this conversation and an overarching, very important component in civics. But what is the correlation between civics education and actual civic engagement? What does that look like?
Yeah, in many ways, K-12 civic education, civic learning is the foundation for, you know, lifelong civic participation. And this is something we've seen in our research over many years. You know, when young people are taught about voting and elections in schools in a nonpartisan way, of course, they are more likely to vote in the future. When young people, you know, have experiences to develop their voice to actually make decisions, you know, as part of their classes or as part of their schools, for example, through programs like participatory budgeting that actually let them, you know, experience what it's like to be in charge of something and to make decisions and to collaborate with others and deal with challenges at institutions. That can have a huge impact. You know, other democratic practices that can be develop in schools. You know, all of this, our research shows, is associated with higher likelihood to participate in civic life, both voting and other forms of participation later in life. And it's also incredibly important because, you know, for many young people, their high school will be one of the last times that they are really engaged in and are part of an institution like this. You know, more than a third of young people do not go on to college. So it's really a time when we have all of young people, you know, together in one place, and we can impart some of these big, you know, lessons and practices and really develop and grow them as voters for the long term.
I'll circle back to that education piece, but yes, point well made. Strike while the iron's hot in K-12 when we're all together in that environment. Beyond that, is there a way, or beyond statistics, I suppose, or voter information following elections, how else can we measure civic engagement?
Yeah, so certainly electoral participation is a big part of it because, you know, elections reach, at least in theory, youth everywhere, right? And it's an opportunity, you know, that we have every 2 years to have big national conversations in which young people play a huge role. But certainly that's not the only way that young people, you know, participate and can lead in their communities and in civic life. I think we've seen in recent years, especially the extraordinary leadership that young people can take in social movements and issue-based movements, whether we think about the gun violence prevention movement after the Parkland shooting and how young people have made that, you know, one of the top issues in the country, whether we think of, you know, climate change or racial justice and the way that youth have led those movements. That's been a really critical part of civic participation. We've also seen increases in other forms of engagement, whether it's, you know, volunteering for a campaign or donating to a campaign, both, you know, an electoral campaign or a campaign on an issue they care about, you know, even boycotting products or signing petitions. So there's a lot of ways for young people to, you know, participate in civic life and in their democracy, and even more locally in their communities, you know, whether it's helping neighbors or really tackling a problem that they see affecting their peers, their families, and their local communities.
Right. Well, as I mentioned to start this call, the Encircle connected with leaders and organizers at conferences and panels and summits across the country and shared insights into supporting youth civic engagement. And some of those insights include strengthening civic engagement in high schools and supporting rural youth and young people who are not in college or working. We also call them opportunity youth. Can you tell us about those key insights? And what kind of feedback you maybe received upon sharing them at X, Y, and Z location, you know, maybe what you learned.
Yeah, certainly. You know, this is why we do our research. We want to connect with practitioners, with folks on the ground who are working directly with young people, because we know that what young people need, or even who young people are, you know, in any given place, is going to look totally different. So, you know, what we do for them and with them needs to look totally different. Rural youth has been a big focus of our work in recent years. We do still see big gaps in participation in election and other ways between rural and urban youth. And what we've found in our research and a lot of what we talked about with partners is that, you know, it goes much beyond whether there's a specific resource or information in a community. A lot of it has to do with belonging. You know, do young people see this as a place that is investing in them so that they want to invest in it or even stay in it long term? You know, do they feel appreciated and respected in the community? All of these things can affect whether young people in rural areas are participating in election or other forms of civic life. Another big piece is, you know, we need to plug efforts to increase young voters in rural areas and in other areas. Those often need to be plugged into work that's already happening. You know, if you think about a local organization, they may not have the ability to start a whole separate, you know, or additional civic engagement program, but how can we incorporate, you know, some civic engagement, some information about voting and elections into work that's already being done so that we are not kind of overburdening organizations or local organizers or leaders, but basically using what already exists and where there's already action and trust and leadership, and infusing, you know, civic content and civic engagement into that. And then, as you mentioned, you know, the focus on non-college youth, opportunity youth, part of that is making sure that young people are learning enough and getting enough civic preparation in high schools, because for the youth who don't go to college, that may be one of our last opportunities to reach them, but it also shouldn't be, right? What does it look like to create and to foster what we call political homes for young people outside of college campuses? You know, what are we doing in local community organizations? What are we doing in jobs, which can do things like, for example, you know, give people time off to vote on election day and things like that. And especially, what are we doing to make sure that enough information reaches youth who are not in college? Because we see that as in our research as one of the biggest sources of inequity. If we look at the information about elections and about political issues that youth in college are getting versus youth who don't have college experience, you know, from local media, from national media, even from people they know, that information is just not flowing as much. So what does it look like to create more sort of information channels for young people who are not in college or who didn't go to college and don't have college experience?
Ideally, when do we have any data or maybe just, you know, anecdotally, when would you have civics education begin? Are we talking, you know, the K here, kindergarten, or are we talking just as young as we can, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we believe that civic education and civic learning, you know, which may not necessarily initially look like a civics and government course, right, of the kind that you can imagine having in middle school and high school. But some type of civic learning can and should begin much, much earlier. Our director actually a couple of years ago worked with the TV show Arthur to, you know, craft some civics content for some episodes, because, you know, young people from the beginning of their lives and of their school experiences are actually having civic experiences, even if we don't think about it that way. They are learning to collaborate with others. They are learning to make decisions. They're learning, you know, how to navigate an institution, right? The school is an institution, just as American democracy is an institution. So all of this stuff is happening anyway, you know, in some form for, you know, young kids in school. And again, it can and should and does, you know, happen in completely non-partisan ways that are about developing skills and dispositions that are key to voting later in life, or key to, you know, personal and professional success later in life too, because that's another thing that we found. You know, these civic skills are also life skills in many ways. So we can absolutely start, you know, as early as elementary school, just you know, infusing into what and how kids are learning the fact that, hey, you have a voice, you have a role in this institution that is, you know, your school, and you are going to have a role, or already have a role, even if you can't vote yet, in American democracy that we are going to start getting you ready for.
I can think of so many questions to ask here, and could easily talk with you for, you know, an hour plus just exploring all these avenues. But to put a bow on this, Alberto, for young people, let's say they're ready to go, they're engaged in civics, they're purposeful, but outside of voting, and maybe they, you know, they're not old enough to vote, you know, and let's say they don't know where to start. Where should they start, maybe outside of voting, like I said, and how can, you know, outside of getting themselves going, how can they also help mobilize their peers to get on board?
Yeah, no, great questions. I mean, I think for young people who want to really have an impact on, again, issues that they may already care about, using those issues as a starting point is a great idea. You know, search for organizations in your local community that may already be doing the work that to have an impact on the things you care about, whether that is, you know, the safety of your community, whether that's, you know, gun violence, whether that's bigger national issues like climate change that we know affect local communities in certain ways as well. So, you know, start there, connect with other people, both your peers and older adults who are already working on the issues you care about, and find, or if you don't find them, try to create opportunities to plug in. In terms of, you know, encouraging your peers and your friends to participate, this is something that's actually, there's been a lot of great work on and a lot of organizations that are supporting youth voter registration in high schools, folks that you can reach out to, and they will actually give you, you know, the resources and the support and the information for example, how to start a voter registration drive in your school, or how to do, you know, voter education events, which you can try partnering with local election officials or other local leaders in your community to do. One of the things that we found in our research is that the majority of states actually have statutes in the books that either encourage or mandate things like there needs to be voter registration forms in high schools, or, you know, young people under 18 can serve as poll workers. This is actually true in most states in the country. You know, teenagers can serve as poll workers, and we've actually found it's a great way for young people to engage, learn about the process, and support the electoral process in their local community. So many things you can do, you know. Again, think about those issues that you care about. Think about whether you are looking to have an impact on the next election, or, you know, even more broadly beyond that. And definitely try to connect with both peers and older adults in your community, because I guarantee any young person listening to this that they are not the only one who cares. They're not the only one who, you know, want to work in or are working on an issue. Finding those connections and building them up will be key to having an impact in your community.
Thanks to Alberto Medina, Communications Lead at the Tufts University Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Art's playlist is next, with a conversation on the intersection between art and social justice. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Art holds a mirror up to society, so it's no surprise there's a long tradition of artists raising awareness and addressing social justice issues through their art. Using a range of art, be it visual, interactive, or performative, artists can engage communities and highlight important cultural and societal concerns. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Wilmington Recovery Cafe Director Michael Kalmbach, founder of the former Art Center Community Mental Health Program Creative Vision Factory that's now part of the cafe, for more on the intersection between art and social justice.
The relationship between art and social change, social justice, really, is a longstanding one. It's nothing new, but it surely takes and has taken varying forms throughout time. From your view, how do you think, you know, what defines art and social justice? How are the two connected?
Well, you know, I think that the two are connected on a really like simple level, and that like we need to, it's a work of imagination. You know, it's like we need to imagine that things could be like measurably better than what they are now. And if we don't have a picture of what that better version of things looks like, like we would just never achieve it. It would just never happen. And so I feel like almost every political campaign is a work of artistry and a work of poetry. You know, you're telling a story. You're telling a story about like how things could come together, how things could take shape, and also too like presenting an analysis. And so I always kind of, you know, loved my time here in Delaware with that kind of proximity to the political machine, because you get to hear and see these narratives that get written off of, you know, our hopes and dreams and aspirations for a more just, more beloved community. And for me, it's like, I don't think that there's anything more artistic than that. I often will use an example of one of my heroes in the community art space, Rick Lowe, who is the founder of Project Row Houses in Houston, Texas. And back before Project Row Houses happened, he was an artist working in Houston, and he was making paintings that kind of referenced what he needed. And there's this young kid who looked at his art and said, look, like we already know all that. If you're an artist and can make anything, how about you make something that we need? And that kind of critique of Rick's paintings from this kid really like opened up a whole world for Rick. And, you know, this is ultimately what, like, you know, leads to the creation of Project Row Houses, a wildly successful organization, but it's centered around the rehabilitation of row houses in a historically Black neighborhood in Houston. And so seeing the success of Project Row Houses today, like, it is, you know, it might look like a community development project. It might look like an affordable housing project. It might look like a program catering to young mothers who need daycare assistance, but ultimately it's also a work of art. And so, I don't know, I think it's definitely fused, you know, if you're going to have to better society, you know, it's also a craft too. You know, it's like we have a craft of going about trying to make things, you know, like I said, measurably better, measurably more healthy. And so I really do see kind of like this community building, community development as an imaginative project.
It's imaginative. It, you know, basically holds up a mirror to society, to the community. I feel like we're seeing more of it these days than we've ever seen it before. But anecdotally, do you think we're seeing an increase in cultural and social activism, essentially, in the arts?
I don't really think so. I think that, like, maybe the awareness of it is great, but, like, I would say that it's really been our bread and butter from the jump. You know, I think that it's never gone anywhere. There's this really great podcast I like to turn people onto, and it's called Change the Story, Change the World, with a guy named Bill Cleveland. And what's wild about this podcast right now, it's kind of like also like an archive of all kinds of artists internationally who are using their work to make like really meaningful, lasting change. You know, I often will listen in to Change the Story, Change the World just for inspiration of, you know, that this is a really rich, deep tradition. I think as rich and as deep as like any kind of modern art trajectories that you might read about in an art history class. You know, artists kind of embedding themselves in community, using these skills of, you know, art, music, dance, poetry, I mean, this full spectrum of practices to really kind of co-create, you know, and bring the artwork kind of out of the studio space, out of the kind of like the genius alone in the garret, and like out in community, in beloved community, you know. And so I think then too, when you get people together around art and music, I forget the quote or who said it exactly, but it goes something along the lines of, you know, people who sing and dance, it's not that it has an impact on their life. It is their life.
Is there a right way to do this? Like, what's the difference in, you know, making use of a small public space compared to a large public space, irregardless of that, where this kind of art is done or presented? How much of a difference does that make? Is it just the attention it'll draw, or is it something more? You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I feel like, you know, there's so many barriers out in the community. There's so many barriers to practice, and, you know, it can be really hard when, you know, just largely we as a nation don't robustly fund the arts. You know, the arts seems to be caught up in this charity model. It's this kind of like this, it's this extra, you know. So I don't know. I think that there's, you know, institutionally, there may not be many opportunities. And then two, it's like, who's underwriting your work in this field? And I think what's fascinating with artists of kind of my generation is that a lot of us were trained, a lot of us, you know, are beneficiaries of Masters of Fine Arts programs that proliferated all over the country. But we're seeing a constriction of the field, a constriction of the jobs here locally in Delaware. We saw the closure of the Delaware College of Art and Design. It seems like these private art schools are the first that are kind of that are dying in this ecosystem. And so I don't know, I think there's a lot of power in working in community and working in this nonprofit sector. But I really do feel like we need to get outside of this this charity logic and understand the benefits and the outcomes that we could get from really deep core investments.
Yeah, and for the artists themselves, you know, it's about, as you said, it's about the process, it's about community in this context. You know, again, when you look at the artists themselves, I think when you're doing this out in such a public space, with so many eyeballs on it, regardless if you're doing graffiti, a mural, dance, whatever it is out in public, it would seem particularly difficult, at least to an extent, for those who do decide to use art as a tool in this sense. It can be, you know, it can be a risk, I think, in ways as much as it can be therapeutic in others, you know, because you're making a stand of sorts. You're making a statement you can't take back. So I guess, what do you think about that in terms of the decision making there and how much of a, maybe not a barrier, but I think a challenge that can be?
Well, I think then too, it's like when we think about work that is like overtly political, you know, it's like you might think about like, you know, like pictures of like people making paintings saying like save the whales, you know. So if we want to be like real literal, you know, sometimes like when you're real literal in the work, I mean, it can really kind of like maybe narrow your audience. But if we're really trying to do the like deep craft and deep investigation and are involved in a long-term project that is really looking at kind of, you know, generational change. I recently heard a conversation with a doctor, therapist, and writer that I really admire, Dr. Gabor Mate, was talking with the meditation teacher Tara Brach. And Tara mentioned that she heard that somebody talked about that perhaps like in talking about peace in the Middle East, that we really need to talk about a 500-year plan. You know, even the concept of a 500-year plan seems to me like a contribution from an artist or a poet. And if we, you know, if thinking that far ahead or thinking through that many generations can kind of take the heat off of us or the pressure for this to particularly work or for this to be effective or for it to meet your target audience, like just look about it, like how much of the analysis for success that we've absorbed from like kind of corporate America and kind of project management worlds, you know, like we may not have any idea what our, you know, like what our projects have had or like how this seed will kind of really, you know, blossom and take root. But the fact that we continue to try, continue to explore and kind of stay curious, I really feel like, you know, that's where some really deep, powerful change happens when we begin to like legitimately like change stories and change the narrative and tell ourselves different stories. And again, too, I think it comes back to like I think largely a lot of what we're up against is failures of imagination, you know, not being able to imagine something different. And so too, it's like, that's where I just really, you know, I trust the work of creativity and artists. And then too, it's like, you know, in this kind of world where everything is kind of, you know, where our arts are funded through this kind of charity analysis, professors of mine used to always love to tell me, Michael, they're not going to fund your revolution. You know, it's like you can't be like going into these funders trying to get them to like undo the whole system. You know, it's like we got to come at it untying these knots, sometimes in really kind of creative, imaginative ways, but also in ways that we're doing and seeking change right in plain sight. And, you know, even a failed project might be something that a generation down the line might be able to pick up and complete. You know, I really feel like, too, it's like a sense of kind of time and tradition. I don't know, now that I'm like in my mid-40s, I think it kind of lands with me a little differently. I think I definitely had a deeper sense of urgency in my mid-20s that I wanted stuff to happen like right now. Like nothing could happen fast enough.
Thanks to Creative Vision Factory founder and Wilmington Recovery Cafe director Michael Kalmbach and R. Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we examine why seasonal allergies are peaking in Delaware and how you can treat them. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. If it seems like your allergies are getting worse, you're probably right. While Delaware's allergy season typically runs from March to October, seasonal allergies are peaking right now due to higher pollen counts. This comes as the first state's allergy season starts to arrive earlier and last longer due to climate change. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon catches up with ChristianaCare internal medicine physician Dr. Amitul Khalid to discuss rising regional allergy rates and how to treat and relieve allergies.
How can people prepare for an uptick in their allergies? What can they do?
So first of all, I'll like to define what is allergy. Allergy is an immune response or overreaction to a substance that is usually harmless to other people. So some people will react to it, other people may not. And these substances are called allergens. And that can be found in dust, pollen, pets, insects, molds, foods, and medications. When we know that some people are allergic to some various things, then you have to be prepared before the season starts. That's the best way to handle it. And there are some medication which can be started in advance to prevent the reaction of the allergen by the patient. When it's time for the allergies, more increased flare of allergic reactions to the patients, then they should, first of all, keep a check of pollen count if they're allergic to pollen. When they know that pollen count is high, then they need to practice some kind of prevention. The best is that avoid the allergens. And avoiding the allergens, you have to protect yourself. If you're going out, you have to cover yourself properly. If it causes itching in your eyes, watery eyes, then you put glasses on. And a hat can be used and mask can be used. And inside your house, you can keep the windows and doors closed and air conditioning can be on. Also, when you're in the car or traveling outside, you can keep the windows closed, not to open the windows. In addition, washing hands, and when you come inside, wash your hands properly. Shower is the best thing that can give steam and clean in inner airways and everything. But if not, then at least wash properly. Change your clothes and put on something different, because there will be a lot of allergens on those clothes. Inside the house, you can also use HEPA filters to remove all the allergens. In addition, reducing humidity can also help with the reaction. So these are all preparations in advance. And then once you are dealing with the allergic season, then you can practice on these measures.
I will say we're seeing a climate change factor in here, as far as we're getting an earlier and a longer allergy season these days. When it comes to preparation, doctor, how does that change the equation here, as in an earlier and a longer allergy season? How are people who don't typically suffer from seasonal allergies affected by a longer season? Do you think more people are affected? Are you able to, do you have an idea of that, either, anecdotally or otherwise?
Yes, if the season is going to be lasting long, like starts early and lasts long, then we are seeing a lot of patients who are coming with cough, upper respiratory symptoms, going on for months, and that's most common cause is allergies. They can have congestion in their nose, post-nasal drip, or headaches. Sometimes that could be caused by allergies. Sometimes patients have watery eyes continuously. They are unable to see clear because the eyes are there's a drainage coming out from the eyes that makes the eyes blurred. If there's a longer season, persistent exposure to allergens, most of the people who are not allergic to things, they should not react. But some people who have mild allergies, they can react more when the season is longer.
Consider me one of those people with allergies that indeed reacts more. But when it comes to this area of the country specifically, are there any state or regional allergens that we should know about?
So it's interesting that when you go to an area, when you move from one area to the other area, you have to get used to the allergens in that area, because the trees are different. Pollens will be different, and your body has to get accustomed to that. So in Delaware, we also need to know that which season, what kind of allergens react more. So in spring season, you see that the leaves are coming out, the flowers are, you see flowers coming out, and there's increased pollen counts. So there are some specific trees, aspen, cedar, hickory, mulberry, oak, and walnut trees, they can cause in spring. Most of the allergies are caused by these allergens. And then in summer, there's grass, and the most allergies come from grass. And the grass is different kind, you know, sweet vernal and Timothy grass and bent orchard and all that. And then there are other plants which can also cause, like wormwood, pigweed, amaranth plants, they can also cause. But in fall season, there are more things come, you know, the mold starts coming, there's more humidity, and then you see mold building up, and that also comes in the picture. And dust mite is throughout the year, you know, wherever you have dust, there's dust mite in the inside the mattresses, in your pillows, in the carpets, that's why, and the all this furniture which is upholstered. So that's why some people have allergies throughout the year, and that's most common causes. That they are allergic to dust mite.
Well, just to follow up on that then, I'm curious, how does where you live then impact whether you'll be affected by allergies? And I mean, for instance, do people in urban areas suffer more than people living in rural areas? How does that factor in?
I mean that in urban areas, there's more air pollution. So in that sense, if you say that there could be more allergies in urban areas, in rural areas, there could be more pollen because there are more trees and more plants and everything. So it could be win-win on both sides.
So, you listed off a number of things we can do to provide relief and prevention when it comes to allergies. When should someone see a specialist about their allergy symptoms when it's just, you know, is it something to keep as an option in your back pocket? Or should you be proactive about it? When should you see a specialist about your allergy symptoms?
So for mild allergies, which can be like runny nose, congestion in the nose, post nasal drip, and patients, most of them are usually used to it. And as you said, that sometimes some people who are not allergic, they can suddenly, when they come to see us, we say, it could be allergies. And they say, we never had allergies. And they are 50, 60 years old. And sometimes they can react to something different in the area. So in those cases, we can start with simple medication. Like we have Claritin, Zyrtec, Allegra. There are a lot of over-the-counter medication. And they have generic versions. They can be used. And then nasal spray helps very effectively for allergies. And if you have rashes, again, these medications can help. But if these symptoms are at a point where the patient cannot tolerate, intolerable, quality of life is being affected, and patient can start having increased symptoms like respiratory symptoms, asthma, patients can have asthma symptoms, wheezing, congestion, cough really bad, unable to sleep, severe reactions, rashes, some people can have hives, face can be swollen, lips and gums can be swollen. Those are very severe reactions, and in those situations, it is a good idea to consult an allergist. So they have specific tests they can do to find out what chemicals or allergens you are allergic to. Some people can also have food allergies, so you know they can also check for that. That if there's a food allergy, you have to avoid taking them. And once they figure out that what are you allergic to, then they can make shots. They're called vaccines for allergy. So for that patient who is allergic to specific allergen, they will make a vaccine for specially for that patient, and they know how to prepare it. So those shots, allergy shots, they can be very effective. And some of the medication, as I mentioned earlier, like Singulair is one of the medication that works better if we start it before the season starts. So if you know that you're allergic to mold, then you start in the end of summer around that time, because fall season there will be more mold around. So the same way, pollen, you can start in the end of winter, and then you will feel better, you know.
Thanks to Christiana Care internal medicine physician, Dr. Amitul Khalid, and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to Delaware Public Media senior producer Kyle McKinnon for making this week's show possible. For him and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.